Yes, guys, what's good? You're tuned in to Pi Radio, Manchester's number one youth-led radio station. My name is Gerns. I'm here with Halima.
Hey, everyone.
And Simran.
Hi, everybody.
Who is looking enviously.
Sorry, but this camera's doing me dirty. I'm way darker than this in real life. This is low-key what I look like before
Don't even annoy me. No, I can even, I can see it on camera.
A little bit, but in real life, it's a lot more.
Oh, you're you are winding me up, you are.
You look good. We get it, whatever.
Oh my God. For those who don't know,
two of us have been on holiday.
It wasn't me, guys, for once.
And we've both been to the South Asian subcontinent. One of us has come back significantly darker. The other one, if anything's come back paler. So, you know.
To be fair, Simran was out there for longer than you.
Also, it was more of like a beach.
Yeah, holiday, she was in the, what was the temperature out there, Simran?
Oh, I think the hottest it was like 35, 36, but most days it was like 31.
Oh, that is so perfect. That's literally like the most ideal weather. Oh, I actually kind of don't want to hear about it.
I don't want to stop the call.
I'm being fully serious. I kind of just want to brush over the fact that you went to Sri Lanka and just not hear about anything.
Goodbye.
Right. Can you give us in a 1 minute, 2 minute summary, Simran?
It was really nice. Visit Sri Lanka. There you go.
Oh,
you know what? That's a very merciful recounting.
I'll just say, right. It's now been 2 weeks since I went, like just over 2 weeks since I went.
Since I flew out.
The thought of the fact that genuinely like a week and a half ago, I was sat on a beach in tropical island paradise, living my life and not having to worry about stakeholders and taxes and my annual review is coming up and oh my God. Yeah. I was snorkeling with turtles a week ago.
Yeah.
And now I'm scanning my barcode to get out of Sainsbury's jail.
Yeah.
I just wanted to buy protein yogurt, you know?
Yeah, you know, like the it really, when you are on holiday, it goes from 100 to zero so quickly. Like
it's almost physically painful.
Yeah, no, it is physically painful. Like the quickness with which you come back to reality and the mundanity, like of your reality is crazy. Like,
you know what it is like? I think a lot of pretty much all my holidays that I've been on since 2022 have been European city breaks, not anything more than four or five nights or whatever. So, the culture's not massively different. I'm not in like a tropical island or anything. I'm not on the beach or nothing. Like, fair enough, like it was hot in some places, but it wasn't like that different in that sense. Like the food, you know, whatever. I don't know what it was. Maybe just how intense the holiday was because we were traveling around a lot, the length of it, the fact that it was so far away from the UK. Like, but no one's taking me seriously when I say, like, when I landed Monday night of this week, by Wednesday, if I didn't look in the mirror at my tan or look at the camera,
you would have known that you went.
You could have told me that I was sitting at my desk the whole week before.
Yeah, honestly, it doesn't feel real. I know.
Like, it's like a massive cognitive dissonance of like being physically on holiday and then going back to your like everyday life and being like, oh, I actually don't feel like I've done anything different.
What's up with that? It's crazy. I always say it like it's almost as if you never went. Like it is actually like you never went.
Yeah. Genuinely, it feels like I didn't go. It's really annoying me now because I'm like, why? All the money, all this, all the like logistics.
I mean, I'm kind of feeling something not similar to that, but a similar kind of idea in terms of the post-holiday blues in the sense that whilst we're in India, this was the first time that I've been and I didn't get ill. Yes, like...
Really?
Yeah, yes, like my toilet trips were maybe slightly looser than they have been in the past.
Oh, wow,
but that's to be expected. It wasn't that I was ill, if you get what I mean.
It's just climate change.
Yeah, and like other food and stuff. Like, that's fine. It was fine. It wasn't that I got deli belly. But I get back, I think I either must have picked up something just as we were there or I picked up something whilst traveling back because this past like week for me, I feel like I'm past the contagious stage. So you don't have to worry, Halima.
Yeah, I'm looking at it very suspiciously.
But this past week, like honestly, like I'd I've just been really run down and ill, and it just really hasn't helped with this whole coming back and having this like mountain of work to do. And if you've like texted me like over the past couple of weeks, I'm really sorry. Like I'm just not replying. I feel like even like you guys, like Halima, you asked like, oh, how was I? I didn't reply for like 2 days. Like, and that's abnormal for me.
I don't even notice.
Yeah. No, but actually it's not that abnormal for me. Like it's weird though. I feel like when I was in school, I was the type of person, and it's weird. I feel like it just shows how much more time you had to yourself. Like I would always just reply back to people straight away, and they'd be like, if they're not replying, I'd be like, well, what are they doing? Whereas now, like,
I'm so sorry. I'm
a not replying merchant. I don't know why I said it's abnormal for you.
No, but that's actually, this might be like a complete separate topic now away from our holidays, but I recently got pressed on this because I used to be a pretty good replier, and then like midway through the year last year, I just stopped replying to people. And then as the notifications build up, I would get more overwhelmed and it'll become more of a job to do. And then I would sit and force myself to reply to people. And then those people, bless them, would reply in like an hour and I'd be back to square one.
Yeah.
It just got too stressful.
Yeah, see, so this is where you lot like haven't helped yourself. If you get that reputation from early on, people don't expect it from you. Like, you lot will message and you'll know, like, might have to message another three more times.
Halima, can you cop in like Doctor Who time machine, go back and talk to me like in like 2010 or something, then please? Like,
yeah.
But in terms of my holiday,
they don't know any of the kerfuffle from beforehand.
Yeah. And again, I don't think it's sensible to go into it. No.
Okay, fair.
I don't think it is.
Yeah.
There was a kerfuffle. There was a kerfuffle. Is what you guys need to know.
Yeah. But
he nearly didn't go.
Yeah, basically. But I did make it, and it was nice. This was the first time that I've been to India and it wasn't summer, which was really nice to experience a bit of a milder climate in terms of not really muggy. It was still nice and sunny, like just before it starts to get proper hot. It was also nice and relaxing because the last time I went to India, it was for a wedding. And I was literally staying at the bride's house. So this time it was a lot more relaxed. Like, we were literally in the same house for most of it. But then it was just so much more of a calmer atmosphere. So it was nice to experience
that. Where did you go? Delhi and Punjab?
Yeah, so went into Delhi, stayed there. And then around halfway through the trip for a couple of days, went to Punjab. And that was also my first time getting a train in India, which was actually... Northern Rail, what are you doing? They get like food and stuff, like it's so nice. Like,
I took a 10-hour train in Sri Lanka, and the guy kept coming with like jar, like tea.
They do have that in
and then we made there was a Sri Lankan family sitting behind us, and the mother just came randomly with this massive Tupperware full of like cakes and pastries that she'd baked as well, and gave those. And we were like,
yeah, honestly, like, UK trains could never. And
I always think this. Every single country I go to, I always think this. Like,
also,
£300 for a ticket to London for what?
Weren't Britain the ones to introduce trains?
The railways. That's their
and
one.
Now look what's happened.
That's their one saving grace. Their one supposed saving grace for colonialism. We gave them the railways.
And now look, they're doing it way better than us.
Look at your head. Anyways.
Yeah, but got the train. That was really nice. And also, I've discovered that every time I've been to India, it's only been to cities. I've been to Mumbai, I've been to Delhi. But this was my first time going into Punjab and being in a bit more, still like city town life. Went to Jalandhar, but it was like a bit more calm. And I actually loved that so much. Like, we went and stayed with my anchor's maternal grandparents' home, where her auntie and uncle still are. I was nice to see all of them because they actually weren't able to come to the wedding, so it was nice to spend time with them. Got this new bling as well. Helene was
into some
before.
Yeah, very nice. Very nice.
What?
It's got a new gold necklace.
Yeah, from my uncle's nanny gave it me.
Very Asian.
Yeah.
All right.
Very nice. But, it was just... It felt so much more like, okay, I've gone on holiday and I'm staying in someone's house. Whereas for some reason, I just don't feel that way in Delhi. I don't know if it's because it's just so busy outside or whether I don't know. It's still nice, but it's just
hard
to
be present because you're probably just like a bit overwhelmed all the time, like a little bit on edge. Like,
but
can't
really
relax.
There's something that was just a lot more warmer when we went to Punjab. And yeah, so I rate it.
Oh, yeah. Love that for you.
It was nice. Then I was saying to Halima, one final thing talking about traveling is she was laughing because I was saying that I got to the airport on the way back 3 hours before my plane. Which
well, no, you said
to
you
do.
Said 3-4 hours at right. first. I was like, it,
my flight was at 7:50, so I got there at 4:30. Like, just aimed like, to get
three,
there.
3.5 hours.
Love that for you. I've also discovered this thing because it happened in when I went to Germany and it happened both ways for Sri Lanka, that they create loads of urgency being like your flight's on final call. Or like go to boarding really fast and then it will be like final call really fast. And then you're through that gate and all they do is put you in a little waiting
exactly,
room for like
yeah,
45 minutes
there,
to an hour.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why did you stress me out? Yeah. I could have been in duty free. Like, run here.
No,
see, they cannot swindle me like this. No. I am too much of a seasoned traveler to ever be swindled in that way. Like, so Carlos and I started having a small debate about, like, well, we didn't really start, but we said we would have a small debate about what is the appropriate amount of time to get to an airport before your flight. Because there are some people who, like, they will, I was laughing at Carlos saying 4 hours, but like, there are some people who, like, that's how long, that's how early they will go, like 4 or 5 hours.
I aim for 3 hours because that's what they tell you to do. So I'm like, okay, I'll listen to them. And it was good that I did because, first of all, I get there. If anyone's ever been to Delhi Airport, it's so confusing. Like they have extra security at the door and it's like you don't know where you're meant to go into. And I was just kind of like, okay, like, and obviously the classic person came up to me and was like, oh, where do you need to go? And like, I was like, you know what, like, I'm on my own, I'm just gonna like give them a bit of money and like, yeah, take me to the gate. I think eventually afterwards I realized, yeah, I could have gone through any door, but I was just like, whatever, like, stress avoided. But once you're through that, then at the check-in desk, like, you know, where you put checking your baggage, that was like queuing for ages. So I was there for like 30-40 minutes just to do that. Then finally get through that and go through to security. And for them, it's like they do immigration, checking out of the country, and then like security in terms of checking your bags. So I went through immigration, all that was fine. Get to security, and again, there's a security for security that checks your passport again.
They are rigorous.
And they looked at my passport and they were like, oh no, you need to go back to immigration. I was like, oh, what's going on now? And it was because it was the 30th of March and they'd stamped my passport, the zero hadn't come out clear enough. So they were literally like, right, need to go back. And I was literally, do I have to queue up again?
Just get a pen and just fill out the zero.
Exactly. That's what they ended up doing in the end. I was like, do I have to queue up again? And it was like, no, just go in. So then I went back to immigration and obviously you had to walk back through. And then they were like, what are you doing? And I was like, they told me to walk back through immigration. Like,
that's so annoying.
And then obviously the guy that had stamped it was then just drew it on with a zero. But then they did let me then go through the special assistance security. So I was like, that was fine. But having said that, I made it through, had a bit of breakfast. I was literally finishing my breakfast and then they were like, yeah, call it to the gate. So I was relatively quick. So like, thank God I had got there in 3 hours because I actually did take that amount of time to get through. So there.
I know for a fact,
if it was me, it would not have taken me 3 hours. I know for a fact. I'm so sorry.
Your India airport and I can raise you Sri Lanka airport.
Go on.
So you get out of the Uber. To get into the airport, they check your passports and boarding passes, yeah? So then we're in the airport, we're through, and then there's like everyone there. So I don't know how we got in getting our passports checked, but all these other people didn't, like the families and stuff, whatever. Then there's a queue for foreigners and there's a queue for Sri Lankan people. But they were getting like checked for something. So we were like, maybe we're not in that queue. We asked the lady at the information desk and she said, no, you need to go to another queue for foreigners. And I was like, okay, another foreigner queue. Went over there and it was like a mixture of everyone. Then you go through like a security where you put like your massive like suitcase and everything through it, like yourself, like you put your own massive suitcase on a conveyor belt, they don't weigh it or nothing, goes through, put your hand luggage through, whatever, you just get it on the other side and go. Then you have check-in desks and then you have the people that want to like take money and help you out. So I don't know how they got past security, but they're there. And then I had to get to my check-in desk, and my check-in desk was also shared with a flight going to Singapore. So I'm asking people if I'm going to the right one. They're like, I'm going to Singapore. And I'm like, I'm so confused right now because there's only one check-in desk here. It took like, I think an hour to get checked in and to get my bags weighed and all that because that people were just taking ages. Did that. Then you have to get your boarding passes checked again. Then you go upstairs and through security, like proper security. Then you have to fill out an immigration form, which they don't specify is just for people from Sri Lanka. So we filled it all out and they were like, yeah, you didn't need to do all that. And then you wait through another queue, go through immigration, and then you can go to duty free.
You know what? It sounds ridiculous, but also I'm like, at least they're thorough. You know what? Like,
you would rather they're thorough than they're not.
It's thorough enough. Like, just the normal way of like check in, give your bag there, and then you go through security with your hand luggage.
Guys, I'll tell you one thing. No matter how bad you think these airports are, nothing will ever be as bad as Dhaka. Just think about the sheer population density of Bangladesh. And Dhaka's like the main airport. We don't really have international regional airports like that in Bangladesh. Like we do, but they're not really like well serviced, right? So Dhaka is like, think about the amount of people in Bangladesh. Everyone is flying from Dhaka. That place is literally like, and you know what's mad as well is that like before you even get in, everyone who's flying, they bring like 20 members of their family with them.
Yeah,
like before you even get in, it's insane. But the good thing about Dhaka is that you could just pay your way in. Like you could just pay your way to the front, you know, which is, it's good.
Oh, but one thing I did also really peeved me and I nearly scrapped both times in the airport was there's not much of a queue system.
Yeah, no, not at all.
And people that are in a rush, they will, it's not even that, it's like they were trying to be subtle, but they weren't.
Yeah.
But there was this man with a backpack on his front and he just dug that backpack into my back the whole time I'm in this queue. And I stood my ground because I was like, ain't no way. I was absolutely not. Until the very end where he just pushed me out the way and just went in front of me. And I was like, cool.
Do you know what I always say? I always tell people, like, you know, every time I go Bangladesh, right? Obviously, it's rarely like a direct. They've only recently started doing like direct flights. So more time you'd have to like stop somewhere in the Middle East, like the Gulf, and then like get your next flight. So the flight from Manchester to the Gulf is like fine. It's nice, calm. As soon as you get to the Gulf, like Qatar, Dubai, whatever, and you go to the gate for the flight to Bangladesh, you could tell that you're going to Bangladesh. There's no queue. There's no system. People are shouting, people are screaming. I'm going to show you guys, Carlos, I want you to like, if this clip goes on air, I want you to clip a video of my sister's video of a flight to Bangladesh. And it's everyone is up, everyone is walking around, everyone is talking to everyone. And the air staff are literally walking through begging people, please sit down, please sit down. And they're just paying them no mind. It's hilarious. Like, it's ridiculous, but it's hilarious. Bengalis are so ungovernable, honestly.
Well, on that note of being ungovernable / rude, returning back to the UK.
Yeah, what?
Manchester has apparently been titled the UK's rudest city.
I'm not going to lie. When I read that, I thought, it's the southerners. Mm. It's the southerners that are coming here and infecting our, like, regional culture.
Mm.
I just want to say,
stop the trains.
I disagree.
Stop the trains.
Listen, I just said I disagree.
That we're not. That we're not rude.
Yeah, you're not rude.
Yeah, we're not, innit? What you're are they on about, man?
You're lovely people, but I will take this one dub. Just anything to convince London me that it's not that bad here.
London was only second. Like,
yeah, I really don't. Firstly, yeah, you know what, Simon, you raise a good point. Firstly, I don't agree. I contest that. I want to see the methodology.
I've got it.
I want to say, like, I don't think London's the rudest. There has to be somewhere worse.
Right. So this is how they've come up with this, right? It's a study that examined data from websites such as TripAdvisor in order to rank cities based on who prioritizes politeness the least. Now, this was also a key thing. I was like, I don't think that not prioritizing politeness equals rude.
Yeah.
I would agree that Manchester people maybe don't prioritize politeness, but that doesn't make them rude.
We're not. Like, I have like a lot of southern friends and they always come to visit me. And the thing that they're always baffed at is like, what, why is everyone so nice? Exactly. Like, they're always like, why is that woman calling me love? Why are they talking to me? Why 100%. Are they giving me a free this? Why have they have a conversation with me? Like, I always tell people, like, when I'm doing my brand ambassador stuff for Manchester, one of the things that I always say is, like, we're just so much nicer up here.
Yeah,
how
can
they say we're rude?
You're all very nice. All very nice people.
Isn't it?
Yeah. I think because apparently they were like sieving through TripAdvisor looking for like keywords. And I think also...
just doesn't seem very scientific to me. I think they're wrong.
We should do our own study.
Yeah, we should. And also, if there is go on, Simran.
Sorry, that was just very much giving like Lad Bible, that post. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, it's just... very much.
It's not, yeah, it's not scientific. It's not scientific, but it's just interesting that Manchester would even be a contender, let alone the top contender. I'm gonna say, if there is any semblance of truth to any of this, I'm blaming it on the Southerners. I'm blaming it on the influx of Southerners that have come up here. I've spoken before about my sentiments on this.
Didn't I send it to one of you two, that sticker that someone put on like a lamp post that's like make Ancoats?
Yeah,
I sent
it.
Yeah.
Oh, was it you?
Yeah.
Was it make Ancoats Northern again?
Yeah. It was make Ancoats rough again.
Oh, rough.
It's so funny. Like, I'm gonna start doing that. I'm gonna start printing my own stuff. Like,
I just, especially if we're going off the metric of prioritizing politeness, there's defo somewhere in the UK worse than London. I actually think London people have gotten kinder since COVID. My experience, people are nice, people are more open to a chat, people are friendlier. Maybe not at like 7 a.m. on a Monday, but in general, I don't think it's that bad.
I just never will get over this one time where it was year 13, so doing like uni visits like before applying, and I went to, I think it was like Goldsmiths to have a look around, and I got the train on my own. I was in London going about, I was in the tube, and like I did that thing where, like, you know, like you kind of like, oh, this way, that way, which way are you gonna go? This person, bear in mind, it's someone I don't know whether this matters, but also it's a woman that is shorter than me. So based on stereotypes, you would like think that I am going to be like
the
stronger.
One.
Yeah, exactly. She grabs me and shoves me to the side.
Oh my god!
And walks past. And I was literally like, oh my gosh, this is London.
Oh my god!
I love that for her. I love that for her.
I mean, yeah, it's a power move. She's girl bossing.
I was just a bit like,
grabbing a man
happened?
That's bigger than you and moving him out the way.
That's crazy. They don't have time. These London people, they do not have time. Like, they will not.
There's just a lot of like self-inflated like importance that leans into that like not having time thing. Yes, you have time. Like, can everyone just relax a little bit?
But
I don't know if I'm just like, I don't know. I don't think it's as bad. To be completely stereotypical, there has to be other places in the South that are worse.
Well, this
I'm not putting fingers, but I am.
I think it also depends on who's going where, because if you look at the highest ranking from the study, they were Cambridge, Newcastle, and Southampton. I'm just a bit like...
Cambridge, yeah, I feel it. But also, I'm not going to lie, like, I feel like my experience of the UK and UK cities is just very racialized as well. Like, I think that to judge whether a city is rude to a like very visibly like Asian person versus like a white person is different, because then I would say maybe like the most unwelcoming and therefore like rude whatever place that I've been to was like Cumbria, which is all the way up north, like in the Lake District. Like, oh my god, that place was like racist. Like, capital R racist.
Also,
like,
if we're going off like TripAdvisor, what's the demographic of people that normally would go on TripAdvisor and leave reviews?
No, exactly, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. So like, it's just, sorry to politicize a fun discussion, guys. But yeah, I would say like, obviously it's kind of, I think the general metric is like the further up north you get, the friendlier people tend to get. But like somewhere like Cumbria, which is like all the way up north, was so hostile towards
me,
you know?
I agree. I think it gets to a point of go how far you can go up north before the demographic goes very much like there's no colored people.
Very homogenous, yeah.
Nor is there no really tourism in that area either.
No, surprisingly there was, like Cumbria, because it's a Lake District, there's bare tourism.
I'm not surprised about that, but like I feel like there's a lot of like spaces up there where there isn't.
Yeah, like the smaller towns and villages and hamlets and all of that, like they're probably a little bit more hostile towards outsiders.
Yeah, like
But then again, like someone, a white person could go to these like quaint little villages and have like, oh my God, the loveliest experience, you know? So.
Well, that's what I mean when I see Cambridge at the top. I know that's not like in Cumbria or whatever, but I can just imagine that the experience of the people that are leaving all these positive reviews on TripAdvisor, I would imagine maybe isn't the same as...
But do you know what? Like, I believe it about Cambridge because I'm not going to lie, like Cambridge is... also full of tourists. Like I remember when I first moved in, like the first week or two that I was there, it was like walking down the road in like London. Like I'd be walking down like near the university buildings and it was inundated with, it's like, you know, Oxford Street, like in peak hours. I'm not even joking. Like you really, like it was like you was like packed in like sardines. So like I think maybe areas where there's like extremely high tourism, maybe like the local people just get very annoyed about it and then they just become very standoffish. So like that might be why somewhere like Cambridge is rude.
No, but they were top. Oh, you mean like...
Cambridge was top?
Yeah, Cambridge was top of the list.
For being rude?
No, for being like not rude.
Oh, I thought you meant the other way around.
No, Cambridge, Newcastle and Southampton were at the top of the list for being
Newcastle, I can see it because it's northern.
Yeah, me too. But like Southampton, I'm confused. In Cambridge, I'm...
Confused.
Yeah. Well, I think I saw something
people
as well.
People weren't that nice to me in Cambridge, not going to lie. Like, they were just like, normal.
That's why I was kind of surprised when you're giving a glowing review just now. I was just kind of a bit like, what's going on?
Like Southampton, like... Yeah, it's southern, but there's not a lot going on there. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, what the hell? What is going on in Southampton?
Maybe nothing
I have no
to
idea.
Go, nothing to go wrong then.
Guys,
maybe.
I've never been further down south than London. Have you?
I've been to Cornwall.
Oh, God, I've never been. Apparently, Cornwall's like a different country.
But apparently, yeah. Like, I just don't understand yet. And this is one main thing I've picked up from my holiday. The extortion that we voluntarily let the UK do to us, yeah, on hotels and staycations and like things that you could like. I stayed one of the nicest hotels we got in Sri Lanka was £30 a night, 30. Yeah,
yeah,
it was not near the airport, so it was more expensive as well. Like, but £30, what would you get here?
Yeah, nothing.
Why is a bog standard, not very nice hotel nowhere near the city center in any city in the UK standard price £110 a night?
Yeah, no, I know. I was literally just about to say about Cornwall. Like, I do want to go because I've never been and I've heard
like
nice things.
But why am I paying extortion?
Every single time I try to like plan a trip to Cornwall, I just think like the amount that I spend.
Lake District, like go if you wanted to go to Wales, go Lake District, go like up north in Scotland or something. Yeah, like, man. Why am I paying?
Whatever money you end up spending, you might as well just go abroad.
You may as well go abroad. And I feel like the one thing we do get here is the cheap flights to Europe, you know?
Exactly. So, like, that's the one saving grace about the UK, I think.
Why would I not just go to Europe?
Which is not good for the economy, but oops.
Bye.
Yeah.
Wow.
But like, no. Like, it was just really annoying. Like, why the extortion? Like, my cousin's getting married, and we're trying to look at hotels in Nottingham, And it's looking too expensive.
Oh, no, your favourite place.
I know. Cheaper, literally, just to drive back down to Slough instead of stay the night.
Really? That's crazy.
You can stay in Manchester, Simran.
What sense does that make? It's the same distance, isn't it?
No.
He just wants you in the studio. Come on.
Yeah, true.
Okay. Midway through the wedding, just BRB.
Yeah.
Turn up in a linger.
I'm Brian.
Well, on the topic of Manchester, there was actually some news regarding Palestine that actually links to Manchester, which had a semi-positive ending, I suppose I want to say. Like, it shows what can be done. But if you don't know what I'm talking about, the events arts place Home, they basically cancelled a Palestinian literature event called Voices of Resistance. I think they cancelled it like last week or something. And the reason they did this is that there was a letter from the Jewish Representative Council of Greater Manchester, which claimed that one of the speakers had engaged in anti-Semitism and Holocaust denial. The event's organiser, Comma Press, said that it was considering legal action because they said the allegations were baseless and libelous, citing a number of examples where this person had literally written about the Holocaust, describing it as one of the darkest moments in human history, which cannot be forgiven or tolerated. So the fact that they were willing to like threaten legal action obviously shows that there was reason to believe that these allegations were baseless. So this letter also objected to use of the word genocide in marketing for the event, which basically this event is going to feature speakers who are family among the 33,000 Palestinians that their health ministry says have been killed by Israel since October 7th. Obviously, the reason why this all kicked off was the Hamas attack in which 1,200 Israeli people died. So in response to the cancellation of this event on Saturday, so a week ago today, there was a protest outside the venue. There was also this mass signed letter, which was signed by nearly 300 artists, including Maxine Peake. And then on Wednesday, this was maybe the most significant event, nearly 100 artists actually withdrew their work from an exhibition at the theatre in support of Comipress, the organiser. And this then led to Home actually restoring the cancelled event, which is now set to take place again on the 22nd of April. So whilst obviously...
All that for what?
Yeah, whilst obviously the fact that this event was cancelled in the first place is just like, don't even want to go into it, it shows that resistance and protest actually can lead to results. So I think if anything is going to be taken from this, like, don't ever say that, like, boycotting, resistance, like taking a stand, don't ever say that that's not going to do anything, because here we have a clear example, albeit small scale, but it is something, you know what I mean? Yeah,
I just think it's, like, just ridiculous, like, why that would even happen in the first place. Like, it's and it's, like, a very typical thing that's been happening in over the past, like, how many months has it been now? Like, 6 months?
Coming on
to 6 months. Like, it's pretty common where, like, arts, especially in, like, the art spaces, where arts organisers are withdrawing Palestinian artists from all sorts of fields and Palestinian-centred events because they don't... Because they're just afraid. I mean, we've spoken about this before, about being afraid to take this, like, political stance.
I think there was a similar thing in Bristol as well that happened.
All over Europe. Yeah. I've seen it all over Europe, where Palestinian artists have now been, like, disproportionately punished for advocating for an end to what is objectively, like, a genocide, you know? Yeah. The fact that, like, I mean, it's disappointing from, who was it that complained? The Manchester...
Let's get the official title. The Jewish Representative Council of Greater Manchester.
I mean, that's very disappointing anyway, like, that would happen. Like, I think it always feels a little bit more like when you're in... When it's, like, your city, right? And, like, you think of, like, your Jewish community as part of being, like, your community in Manchester. It's disappointing that that's the kind of stance that they would take. Mm. I can't speak, obviously, for all the Israelis or people who are, like, you know, have a relationship with Israel. But when it's in your community, I feel like there's a more personal level of disappointment, because, like, in Manchester, you know, like, the minorities in Manchester, like, there is a kind of, like, you know, kinship and camaraderie there, I would say. So that's disappointing that they would, like, object to an event like that and go as far as, like, you know, throwing out what appeared to be baseless accusations.
Mm. Yeah, that, and also just still debating as to whether or not this is a genocide when, like, there's, like, over 30,000 people died.
Yeah, like, this is not... We're so past that point of debate, you know? Like,
I just realised as well, like, it is 6 months tomorrow, because it's...
The 7th of April, yeah. So, like, yeah, it's just disappointing. It's disappointing that Home would put on an event like this, knowing what it meant, and then retract it on the basis of one letter.
Also, like, I don't understand, like, not to condone if this were to be true, which it seems like it's not, but say if it were, right?
Take him out.
Yeah, exactly. This is one speaker.
Yeah.
Like, why does this person represent, like, the whole event? Like,
yeah, like, you lot have put this event on because you know that it's important, that it's significant, to then just completely take it away because of one detractor. Like,
yeah.
Disappointing.
I mean, also in regards to Palestine, I think the thing that's been dominating the news over the past week or so, and it's been interesting as well, because we really are starting to see the majority of media turning around and being like, hang on, actually, maybe this isn't a good idea, which is it took 6 months.
Slowly starting to call for a ceasefire more and more now.
And I suppose it is a bit interesting now, obviously, that it's British people that are involved in this most recent thing as well. I don't know if that has anything to do with it. But seven aid workers, including three British people, were killed in airstrikes in Gaza carried out by Israel's army, I think it was on Monday. I mean, even today, former Prime Minister Boris Johnson and also former Foreign Secretary, he said that it's shameful that the UK would even debate to end arms sales to Israel. He said that it would be insane and that it would be willing the military defeat of Israel and the victory of Hamas.
So I think at this point, like, it's, I'll tell you what is insane, Boris Johnson. At this point, after like 6 months and a death toll of 33,000 and counting, the fact that you can dichotomize it into an issue of Israel good, Hamas bad, that's what's insane. The fact that you think those are the two actors in this, that's what's insane. The fact that you don't, you cannot see that it's a question of genocide, it's a question of Palestinian liberation, not just Hamas, a Hamas victory, but Palestinian liberation is insane. That's what's crazy.
But you know what? It shows that the like discourse has come nowhere in 6 months. Because I know, Carlos, you said like news and media outlets are now starting to turn more to the side of like calling for a ceasefire and recognizing that it's like a genocide and that it's obviously very much one-sided, right, what's going on. And I remember saying a couple months ago that, like, I remember watching BBC News one day and they were started reporting it very different. Like, it was less, like you said, Halima, dichotomized, and it was more like, oh, this is really unfair. And for the first time, I was like, had a little bit of hope in that sense. And I was like, oh, this actually kind of is looking up a little bit. The fact that when I say we've made no progress in 6 months in terms of like how we're treating it, because it's like, think about what the all the conversations were in October, November time when anyone would talk about it and it would be like, but do you condemn Hamas though? But do you condemn Hamas? And it's like, wait, like that's not even what we're talking about here. And why did we have to talk about it connected to condemning Hamas? We can't just talk about these attacks. And like everyone has kind of seen, like the now international outrage, especially from Rishi Sunak in the UK, because now British lives have been lost. But are we surprised?
It's like, so the reason why there's this debate about, oh, should, like now there's this debate about, oh, should the UK stop supplying arms, is that more than 600 lawyers, including former Supreme Court justices, this week wrote to the government saying weapon exports to Israel must end because the UK risks breaking international law over a plausible risk of genocide in Gaza.
There's already been, I'm not sure where these cases are at, but there's already been a number of countries that have said that they want to take, following South Africa taking Israel to The Hague, like there's already been a number of countries that have said that they want to take the US, UK, Canada, France, I think, from the top of my head, I think that's it was them for, also to The Hague for aiding and abetting this genocide, which, I mean, like, we've spoken before on this show about Britain's personal economic gain, because all war is, there is a financial kind of a gain to it, because if Israel are indiscriminately have killed up to 33,000 people, where are they getting the weapons to do so, you know? And some of their weaponry and their arms are from British manufacturers. There is a group called Palestine Action, PAL Action, who their form of protest is basically they take over and shut down like arms factories that supply to Israel. You should if you're listening, you should check them out, like try and support them and stuff like that. But it's a proven kind of like economic gain for the UK. That is obviously the kind of background to why Boris Johnson has come out and said like, oh, it would be insane to stop arms to Israel. It's not necessarily because he believes in like the ideological victory or like the ideological need for Israel's victory. It's in my opinion, it's a purely kind of economic,
financial. 100%. Which
motivation.
Is so ironic because the UK is in a recession anyway.
No, well, yeah, exactly. That's because like it's personal gain. Like it's not even a
100%.
You know, like it's
he's vested.
I think as a closing point, on this, obviously mourn the lives of everyone that has lost, not even in this most recent series of events, but since this whole, for need of a better word, conflict started. But also, obviously, want to give a particular mention for the 7 aid workers who did die. Obviously, they were helping people at the end of the day. They were risking their lives to help people.
It's like, where do you, when you talk about what's been going on in Palestine, it's kind of like, where do you draw the line of, this is the most tragic thing that could happen, you know? It's like every, and once again, like, this is something that I always say when we talk about this, but it's kind of like every time that you think, like, the Israeli war machine cannot get any more depraved, like, or they cannot, you know, there's a boundary that they won't cross, or there's, like, an international law that they might honour, you come to learn that there's nowhere that they will not go.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, their response to this has been, they bombed, so it's like they bombed the cars that these aid workers were in, right? And they've said the reason why it happened is because there was a belief that Hamas were inside the cars.
This is like the 65th time that we've heard that.
Excuse for everything. They will bomb anywhere, anything.
That's what they said when they bombed the first hospital. The first one, which actually adds to Halima's point nicely about when you think there's a line they won't cross, just gone and crossed it.
It just goes to show.
Was like, how many hospitals ago?
Exactly. Do you remember like the outrage and the like kind of vehement like denial? We didn't do this. We would never do this. It was Hamas, blah, 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 blah. And now there's not a single there's not a single fully functioning hospital left in the entirety of Gaza now.
First it was like, but do you condemn Hamas and they started this conflict that's happening right now and blah 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 blah, and then it was like, but there were hostages and we need the hostages back, and then they were like, well actually we don't really care about the hostages because they're being treated really nice over there. And now it's like, well then the hospital thing started, and then and now the aid workers, and I feel like it's so many series of events that you think it can't get more depraved.
I hope that people are starting to like wake up and see like this excuse, like Hamas have always been a scapegoat for the Israeli like colonial project. Hamas, I've said before when I did like my long explanation of this conflict, but Hamas only came into creation 40 years after Israel and Palestine like had basically, Israel was created basically, that Hamas only came into creation 40 years after Israel had been created. For 40 years Palestinians had lobbied politically. Hamas only came out as a kind of a measure of them basically not getting any political liberties, having lobbied politically. And they have been used as a scapegoat for Israeli violence. Like they've been used as like a little smokescreen as an excuse for Israeli violence. And we see that now, like Israel have been indiscriminately bombing anywhere, anyone, under the pretense that, hey, there's Hamas here, there's Hamas here, there's Hamas here. Even like when South Africa took them to The Hague, I'm laughing because of how absurd it is. Even when South Africa took them to The Hague, there were literally Israeli statespeople that were like, oh, but we have intel that there are some, you know, people like there who have links with Hamas. Like,
yeah, I mean, the response to this as well is the two people have been fired. It's not going to bring anyone back to life. Like,
it's crazy.
But yeah, to finish this discussion between the three of us on a more positive note, thought we could talk a little bit about some pop culture. So, Simran, first of all, I thought this one might be of interest to you. Have you seen...
I don't know what you're going to ask me.
You know?
I think I know.
What?
The...
Like all the Drake and the future. All my parents are fighting. I don't like
Well, the main thing that Halima, to give you a bit of context...
Yeah, guys, I'm not on social media anymore, so I don't know.
But I actually haven't got a clue what's going on, I'll be honest.
So... In October last year, Drake released his album For All the Dogs, which featured a collaboration with J. Cole called First Person Shooter. In one verse, J. Cole suggested that he, Drake, and Kendrick Lamar were the big three of the current era of hip-hop. First of all, Simran, thoughts on that?
I'm scared. As someone who's a big Drake, J. Cole, and Kendrick Lamar fan, I used to really like J. Cole and Kendrick Lamar. Like, I used to be like one of those people that used to like dissect lyrics and be like, oh my God, this is going over your heads. Like, no one can even comprehend. No one can comprehend these lyrics the way that I'm comprehending these lyrics. Anyway, I'm not saying anything because people are going to disagree.
Okay.
And I'm scared.
Well, then Kendrick released a track which kind of took aim at what Cole had said. So obviously Cole had kind of been saying like, oh, him, like, Drake and
like
Kendrick.
A compliment.
Yeah. Then Kendrick came back and said, there's no big three. It's just big me.
Big me. But it's awkward because when you actually go back like 10, 15 years, like 15 years, longer than 15 years, Drake co-signed Kendrick Lamar initially and so did J. Cole. Like, if you really want to peel it back, like, they're kind of the reason why he got such a big name, like,
Their come up was, like, at a similar time, especially J. Cole and Kendrick. Like, I started listening to them both at the same time, like, and they were blowing at the same time. They were making kind of very similar waves in the music industry around at the same time. And they've always had a very, very good, like, working relationship. Like, they collab with each other. They always gave shout-outs to each other. They've always had a very, very, like, strong camaraderie, particularly J. Cole and Kendrick, but all three of them. So I completely understand where J. Cole has come from when he comes out and says like we're the big three. I think that over the past decade and a half, they have, all three of them have had very, very like impactful reverberations on the music industry. But also like we have to understand like it's probably all planned. Like it's probably all just PR. Like that's a lot of this. Like if you know these artists, you know they have a very good like brotherly type kind of relationships, right? So if that's kind of what's happening, then probably it's just publicity.
It just seems so, in my opinion, like unnecessary. Like so, and Kendrick in his track, he basically,
and also if you know Kendrick as an artist, he doesn't take shots like that.
Yeah,
like,
even,
he doesn't,
like,
he
doesn't
get involved in like, yeah, he doesn't get involved in like
very futile, like everyone's just being like there's just like I don't really
I think it's all just PR
behind it, you know.
Well, Kendrick basically implied that J. Cole is irrelevant basically and said that Kendrick is the prince to Drake's Michael Jackson, basically pushing Kendrick out the picture.
But that's kind of weird. And also, even if, okay, so if this is like a planned PR stunt, that's a really big claim to make.
I think I just say whatever's provocative personally.
Well, the most recent event in this series of events is that on Friday, J. Cole basically released a new...
why is Central...
I don't know. But J. Cole, in his... in his new album, basically replied to Kendrick, and he basically was just dissing him again and saying that he fell off, basically. Like,
why does everyone think that like Sprinter dropped and the world changed?
Wait, Central C?
I think
Central C's on the album.
Yeah, but it's like in this track, J. Cole is basically saying that Kendrick fell off. Like, that's his response to the whole thing. Like, but he used to admire him, and now he doesn't.
Interesting.
It was a very unpopular opinion that the album To Pimp a Butterfly, it's not his best, but people are like, oh, it's like a work of art, like da da da.
Politically,
it is.
Politically, it's one of his best works. Sonically, no.
Wait, it sounds and stuff, no.
Yeah, sonically, I don't agree, but it's his best. But politically, yes, it is the most impactful.
And then, to be honest, the most recent one, not really, wasn't my taste. But then the same can be said for J. Cole. So, and also, if you want to compare to Drake, he's got such a big production value and team behind him now that, like,
I was gonna say they're not comparable artists. Yeah. Like, and both that
Drake's not writing his own stuff as much. I think it's pretty much common knowledge now. And the work rate at which Drake puts out albums, obviously not all of them are gonna be 10 out of 10.
It's they're not comparable at all. Like, I think people tend to group them together because of this camaraderie that they had, and like their come up was like similar times and stuff like
but
that.
But they don't even make the same kind of music.
But then exactly, like Kendrick and Cole both started off in the conscious rap like kind of genre. Like that's really what their come up was. Drake never did conscious rap. Like Drake,
it was mainstream. It was like leaning on pop where it is pop.
Yeah, exactly. Drake never did any of that. So like it's.
So I don't think it is comparable.
It's a bit of a redundant. It's a redundant comparison.
It's a very much like 10-year-old like debate about who's the best rapper and blah blah blah.
Yeah, but Simran will get us views, so go
crazy
on.
About it. Huh?
Yeah, Simran will get us views, though, so go on.
True. But all I'm saying is Kanye West is getting crazier by the day, and it's terrifying.
It is kind of terrifying.
Every time I see something, do you see the stuff that came out about what he was doing at Yeezy?
I don't know, someone's
suing him, no?
I think so.
Yeah.
Oh, I did see that, yeah. Anyway, staying on positive note, we've got a couple minutes left. So just briefly wanted to, we can't really discuss it because I haven't seen it yet, but I do want to see it. Want to give Dev Patel his flowers.
Oh, I really want to go see it. It came out yesterday. I'm gonna go see it. Listen, we need to be supporting that man because he gets like he has almost kind of like a cult following. Dev Patel, like he has.
I'm part of it.
Yeah, like on the internet, there's like a kind of, you know, a large part of the internet. Like everyone, I've never heard anyone say anything bad about him. Everyone swoons over him.
Yeah,
I'm not gonna lie. I think physically, I'm not gonna say
it's just something about him. I'll send you some fan cams on TikTok.
I think he's very cute. I think he's like objectively extremely good looking, but anyways, my point is that I do really like him. Maybe it's just like the South Asian bias, I'm not gonna lie, but like I do really like him. And a lot of people are saying like, why are we not seeing him more, especially in rom-coms?
Yeah.
Like he has said that he would be the perfect candidate for rom-com because all the girls love him. All the women love him.
I don't know if it was fake news. I think he's going to be
Simone Ashley. If that happens, I'm throwing a viewing party. Forget Cineworld. Forget Odeon. Everyone's coming to my house to watch it. That's a South Asian representation love story that we need. I'm so sorry. Like, yeah, over the years, we've gotten like small South Asian representation, but it's always in like a mixed couple. It's always with like a South Asian person and a white person.
Yeah.
If they give us a South Asian on South Asian love story, I'm telling you, I'm throwing a viewing party. But anyways, all this to say, I do really like Dev Patel and I do really wish that they would cast him more in, you know, like rom-coms and whatever, because he would be, as I say, the perfect candidate. The ladies love him. Like they would flock to the cinemas to watch him. And I can only theorize that he has not had perhaps the success that he should have had.
Yeah.
Because typically South Asian men and women are kind of like desexualized and not really seen as, you know, attractive or desirable.
A bend it like Beckham example.
You know, so.
Yeah. But as a closing thing, I just wanted to reflect, he had an interview on BBC Asian Network earlier this week.
Oh, yeah,
Dev Patel, if you're interested, we would also.
We'll do a better interview with you, Dev Patel.
But.
Also, Dev Patel is the most Gujarati name I've ever heard. I'm not even joking. I think I personally know like 3 Dev Patels.
But
everyone knows a Dev Patel.
Yeah, but it's a pretty superstar name though.
But he was asked by like a listener, do you want to be the next James Bond? And his response was so good. He was basically like, the reason why I made this film Monkey Man is because I wanted to create roles. Like he basically, it's a bit boring that everyone wants to be James Bond. He's like, I want to create roles that young South Asian people will be like, oh, I want to
be that person. Way.
Or something like he would have been like, I want to be a monkey. So he was like to this, I think it was a young listener. He was like, I hope you'll grow up and want to be Monkey Man when you're older.
Rather than James Bond. James Bond, it's true. You know, like this debate about kind of racializing James Bond. James Bond is white. Guys, like that's his whole characterization. He is white. He is supposed to be white. The things that he can do with impunity, his entire character is informed by the fact that he is a white man. Like I don't think it's everything that we should do race bending in. A much more worthwhile endeavor is to create counterpart ethnic kind of characters and roles that, you know, young black and brown men can look up to instead.
Sure. Right, we're going to have to end things there, but we are going to give Stormzy and AP Dylan's new track a play.
Oh, guys, I've not listened to it properly because it's Ramadan and I'm abstaining from music. I'm trying to be a good Muslim. But I've heard obviously like the snippets and stuff on TikToky. And Carlos and I were saying this before, like I'm so gassed at the collab. Like when I first saw that they were collabing, I was extremely gassed because AP Dylan, I speak all the time about how much I love him. Like he is one of my favorite artists of all time. Like the love I have for that man, I'm ride or die. I love him so much. So I'm so excited that he is collabing also with Stormzy, who I also really, really love. Not just like as a musician, but I just love Stormzy as like a celebrity, you know? Like I just love him as a figure. I think he's so cool. I think he's very down to earth. He's very politically aware. Like I just love the excitement of like these two parts of my world like kind of colliding. Like I really love that. And I love that. Again, we've spoken, I think, before on the show about Bhangra music really getting like an international spotlight with these like cross-cultural and cross-genre collabs. Huh?
Oh, no, Karen.
Like these cross-cultural, cross-genre collabs, which this is like just another exciting example of. But the song itself isn't his best.
Yeah.
From the snippet that I've heard.
I really like AP Dylan's part of it. I do think Storms is a little misplaced.
I agree.
Really think he could have come in with more impact than you lot think I'm a donut.
Exactly. I was just like, wait, what?
I haven't heard it yet, guys.
Of all the nouns he could have used, you know?
Yeah, you'll see. But it's not bad.
It's not a bad song. I really like the beat. I do think AP Dylan does well on beats like that, but then he also does well on his like Loverboy beats.
He's
as well,
sick, so
like,
man. He does well in everything. What can the man not do? Nothing.
But that's actually the same as Stormzy, to be fair. He does well on both. Like, so they're actually well suited in that way. Mm-hmm. My thing is, yeah, and I love how much recognition the Punjabi music scene's getting.
Yeah, I love that. I love that.
always am on the lookout because obviously I see how much like say Dilja, AP, whoever's doing the collab.
Mm.
The marketing for it on their side, and then I always pre how much the other person
is doing. Yeah,
and I understand the Punjabi artist is probably getting more help and like presence from this than the like English or US based artist, right?
In a Western context,
you're right. But even just in terms of like numbers, right? Just like say Instagram following, if you want to put it down to that,
yeah.
Like Dilja Dosanjh and Saweetie did a collab.
Yeah, I was gonna bring that up.
I posted it.
I was gonna bring that up.
Everyone's putting that photo shoot around and sending it around and saying, oh my god, this is a big deal.
But also, like,
personally,
I
didn't see her post it.
But also, I think like this is just like Western, like kind of like superiority because like Dilja Dosanjh, even just by numbers. I'm sorry, is a much bigger artist than Saweetie.
Mm.
Like, he is a...
On a global scale. Yeah.
He is clear. Mm. He is so clear, you know?
Like, but it's like, okay, I'm really sorry to be this person, but, like, if it was Bad Bunny, would you be posting it?
Yeah, you get. And, like, Dilja is a better and much more popular artist than you. He clears you. I'm so sorry.
That's what I mean.
In my opinion. It was a cute collab, though. Like, I liked...
It was cute.
Yeah,
it
was cute.
The songs are nice. The marketing is great. But I would just love to see it being equally marketed on both artists.
That's why I love Burna Boy. Because Burna Boy really, like, he is riding for Sidhu Mooswala, R.I.P. Like, he really is, like... I'm seeing him in his shows, his live shows and stuff. He'll be shouting out like Sidhu, like he's really ride and die, and I back that. I really back that.
No, I agree. But like, yeah, even with like this Stormzy one, like Stormzy, from what I saw personally, I could be wrong, but he just posted a story. Whereas AP,
he did TikToks. Yeah, okay, yeah.
Good. But I want is for it to be equally marketed on both parties.
Yeah, no, I hear that. Like it's good, it's great to see. But there's still a lot more in terms of like giving their due respect. Maybe not quite there yet.
Right. We need to put it on so you can have. Are you going to listen to it?
What? I mean, I'm in the studio. Yeah, I'll listen.
Stay tuned though, because after this track, we're going to be chatting to Kapil Sishasai about his new track, One Minor, and what he's been up to over the past year. So do not go anywhere. Bye, Simran.
Bye.
Yes, guys, what's good? You tuned into Mango Masala, Pi Radio South Asian show, and I am now joined again by Kapil Sishasai. How are you doing?
I am fantastic. How are you getting on?
I'm good. We were just saying before, obviously, it's been a year and a couple of months since we last had you on the show. I think you were probably our first episode of 2023. Mm-hmm. I think it was around that time. Obviously, you'd just... It released your LP Lal, which was a concept album focusing on the influence of Bollywood and Indian cinema, covering concepts such as caste, nationalism, censorship. There's a lot going on there. So it was really nice to speak about that project as a whole with you. But obviously a year and a bit has passed since then. So what have you been up to?
I think people forget that an album cycle kind of begins when it's available to listen to in full. Like when you work on a body of music, the end of the album cycle is finishing it and sticking it out there. Whereas now it's like you stick it out there and then you begin promoting it, because at long last, everyone can hear the whole thing and not just here's a single, here's a 30-second teaser. So a significant amount of time there was spent just kind of beginning the PR cycle around the album. And I went on a big journey, kind of not learning just who's into the album, but who am I as an artist and what am I trying to say? And this isn't me coming at you with my politics are any different or I'd write music any different. Like everything I wrote on that album, I still believe to the, you know, to the fullest of my opinions on anything. I still want to fight caste and nationalism and censorship with my music, but it took a long time to figure out what kind of audience Lal has. I mean, I had lovely people like yourself platforming the record really early on, just as it came out. And I've been really lucky to have support from like BBC Asian Network and, you know, a lot of fellow artists and like festivals like Dialed In and the DJ Collective Daytimers, etc. But unfortunately, I put the record out and I had a team around me that weren't the best fit. And I think there was a bit of a tight mismatch between who made the record and who was helping promote it a little bit. And I think that what people who might not play music or work in the industry maybe won't realize is a lot of finding who to work with, it's a bit like dating. Like we were talking about getting married and all that kind of stuff. And I'm happily married to someone who plays music with me on stage. So I'm quite spoiled in that regard. But when it came to having a team around me to work on the record with, the record came out and I worked with people who were based in Scotland, but if I'm being transparent about it, the British Asian scene in Scotland leaves a lot to be desired at this point in time. It's developing really slowly. There's some cool stuff happening, but it's just not on par with what's happening in the north of England or what's happening in the Midlands or in London. And, you know, I love Scotland. I'm always going to think of myself as Scottish and I'm always going to live here, but it took going to these places like Manchester, like London, like Birmingham, to figure out that the community built around the album is more nucleated around those places than it is in Scotland per se, and has an odd, it enjoys a small following here in Scotland, but I've kind of learned like where do I fit into the Scottish ecosystem and where do I fit into the UK ecosystem. And I realized I really want to connect with people who get what the songs are about. It's not enough to just kind of bop along and go, oh, that's a cool guitar part. I really grind when it comes to like the lyrics, the themes I explore. And I'd rather not, you know, lose all my sanity going into an audience who might not fully be invested in what I'm singing about. I had a couple of people reach out who were in America who were really into like a couple of the lyrical themes on Lal, and they were so specific about specific lyrical Easter eggs that they were into. The example one of them chose was there's a song called The Item Girl on the record, and it's about the item girl trope in Bollywood and how a woman who owns her sexuality is not thought of as desirable as much as a subservient woman would be in South Asian circles. And I referenced this painting called Who's Afraid of Red, Yellow, and Blue, which is a painting by Dutch-American painter Barnett Newman. And this painting is just three vertical lines, or four in some cases. But decades ago, people were so offended that this passed for art these days that someone slashed it with a box cutter in a gallery and they had to hide it from the public. But they tried to restore the painting and then they brought it back, but someone was offended at the restoration job being kind of crap. So they slashed it again. And now this painting is out of sight because everyone's worried about the next time someone's going to attack this inanimate bit of canvas. And that story really spoke to me about what does it mean to offend somebody? What's offensive? And as soon as I got this bit of fan mail about this lyric, I was like, wow, someone out there is actually listening to what I'm doing. And there was like a tipping point after that where over time I developed this really engaged fan base online. And then I kind of learned that I grew up in white boy indie guitar circles where you'd hop in a smelly van and tour up and down the country. But that's not actually where I'm at as an artist. Like there's a mismatch between what I thought I'd need to do to build an audience and what's actually happening. What's ended up happening is my most engaged following come from like my content, my video essays, some of the music stuff I do to explain why I sing about what I'm singing. And a lot of people now know me for as much about my content as they do about my music. And the two obviously cross over quite a bit. But me learning, oh, wow, there's this kind of needing to be chronically online thing that means that I build these real fans that I've always dreamt of having. But you know, I'm preaching to the choir here. You're obviously quite online with the radio station and stuff. You need to find a way to protect yourself when you're online that much. And here's the thing. I, in my head, thought, oh, people who like guitar music, people who are like maybe millennials, just like me, will be really into the album. But when I looked into it, the average fan of Lal was born as I went to university, which to me was quite, wow, how is that the case? It's like someone would leave me a really nice comment. I'd skate past their profile and be like, oh, what kind of person is this that was really kind about my music? And it says, oh, why does this person's name have 08 at the end of it? And it kind of gave me the existential crisis of, oh, I was literally already an adult when this person was born. But it's a great responsibility to be trusted with such an engaged audience. Even if they're a bit younger, that's fine. I don't want to speak for you, but I've noticed that I think I'm in my, you know, I'm going to be in my mid-30s very soon. And it's like people in their 30s seem to be hitting their midlife crisis point earlier than I remember with previous generations. When I was growing up, people in their 50s would be doing the buying a motorbike, getting a ponytail, getting a leather jacket, all that kind of stuff. But it feels like millennials are hitting that point in their late 20s. And it just kind of feels like people my age aren't typically looking for new music to listen to. They're kind of in that nostalgia thing. And that's fair enough. But realizing that younger people really take to Lal and what it's about means that I had to change up everything I did. Everything needed to be like, right, well, if people in Toronto really like the album, I can only get to them once every 2 or 3 years. I can't go there all the time. I mean, even getting to London and even getting to Manchester, etc. I played Manchester once since the last interview. I was lucky enough to play Manchester Jazz Festival. I opened for Aaron Ghosh, who's a bit of a local hero up that way as well. And, you know, as amazing as it was to play that show, I can't play even Manchester multiple times a year. It tends to be one or two specific shows that make a lot of sense in the context of the music I make that I'd play. And yeah, I've had to really change the way I do it. I have to be constantly in touch with my audience, but distant enough in a, I'm the last person who's going to get on stream or get on Instagram and act like I'm any younger than I am. I'm at a weird point in my life where I'm discovering new things. I'm really into a lot of things that I wasn't into before. Like, I didn't realize I'd be so into things like fashion and streetwear. And I'm really interested because I feel like South Asian culture, as much as it's taken off of music, it's taken off in fashion as well. Like, there's so many interesting fusions of things like streetwear with like really regional Indian like textile styles all combining. And if you go to festivals like Dialed In, etc., you start to see like fusions of styles in fashion as much as music and culture, and it's fascinating to me. And I want to explore that from a point of view of that's something I'm genuinely interested in. But I went through a phase of worrying about, oh, am I going to be that cringy older guy who's trying to dress young to get to the kids or whatever? But my audience see that it comes from this genuine point of interest. Like, I'm really interested in, you can see this pile of sneakers behind me developing. And a lot of that, you know, there's some small batch of designs there that weren't too expensive because the designers weren't as well known. But there's also some like massive, like, you know, there's like Converse and stuff there too. It's like, I've got this new hobby. I need to find a way to balance out music being a job. I'm sure you feel that way too. Like, you know, working in the entertainment industry is incredible, especially if you get to do it for a living, but you can't do it all the time. You need to find like a point of balance, right? And for me, finding other hobbies like streetwear and stuff, integrating that into my personality online has been really fulfilling because it turns out a lot of my audience enjoy the same other things that aren't music that I do. So Lal's enjoyed quite a lot of success. It was written about Rolling Stone and The Guardian. It was nominated for Scottish Album of the Year. I got to perform it at the Roundhouse in London, played quite a few festivals like Manchester Jazz Festival, and I got to do a Radio 4 live session with it. Where it's been more slow to grow is in those kind of metrics, like things like streaming. But over the past 6 months, those have really taken off as well. And we live in an era where you're judged completely on your follower count and your streams. But ever since hitting a stride with content, I know exactly what I'm doing now. And what's beautiful about that is you just have to refine this one thing that you do. You don't have to worry about doing every new trendy thing, because your audience come to you for a thing, you give them the thing, you get better at the thing over time, and it means that I can compartmentalize music and put it here, I can go over there, I can hang out with my wife, I can have my sneaker collecting habit, I can get into whiskey, it doesn't matter. It's like you can find a sustainable way to live your life, and Lal kind of taught me to do that, and it's been wonderful to go on that journey. I'm not going to lie, it was incredibly difficult. I went through phases of wanting to give up music altogether because I thought, I don't understand how to be successful. I don't know how to build an audience. But it turns out, build it and they will come couldn't be more true. And I think that if there's any artists listening, honestly, just make the music you want to make. If you're authentic, people will notice that and people will react to it positively like they have with me, I think. So yeah, it's been an amazing journey since Lal came out, but it's time to move on to the next chapter, I think.
Well, it's funny as well, because I think a lot of what you've been saying just now actually kind of reflects the topic area of this new single as well.
Yeah.
So the reason why we're here today is because you have released your new single, One Minor, and I'm going to ask you to like tell us a little bit about it. But I think as well, it's really interesting how, from my understanding from like the press brief and stuff, it very much does focus on this idea of being very worried and constantly thinking about people's perception of you or staying on the right path, whatever, so much so that you actually end up missing opportunities that are coming in real time. But yeah, I'll let you get into it now. So like, what is One Minor about for you?
Sonically, One Minor sounds a bit like Lal would have sounded if there hadn't been a pandemic. I wasn't allowed to be in the same room as my producer drummer, who lives an hour away from me, which isn't far, but it was during the pandemic. We all remember being bubbled and not being able to see people. And because I wasn't yet married yet, me and my wife couldn't see each other. And like, she plays flute on the record as well. So my album, Lal, as successful as it became eventually, it's not a very live album. It's got a very bedroom pop energy because it had to be done remotely. And I thought, I built up a really good live show with Lal, but people would keep going back to the record and going, oh, why doesn't the record sound as wild as the live show? And it's like, well, that's what the pandemic will do. So with this new single or next run of singles, One Minor being the first one, I'm going to be leaning into the live sound a little bit. Like, if you're into this, come to one of the gigs, leaning into the strengths of my live band. Like, you know, I've been blessed to have such a talented group of musicians behind me. My drummer, Debt for Young Fathers, last summer, they were on tour with Depeche Mode. He was playing like Old Trafford, touring arenas for a summer. And it made me think, all right, he's one of my best friends, but he's going to fly the nest. It's time to let him go. But no, he's so invested in what I wanted to do. The minute he was done with his arena tour activities, he was like, no, let's get right back to it. You know, he's playing to no more than 500 people at most with me at the moment. But to know that he's this invested in the project means that it makes sense that it should include him a bit more. This new single's got a lot more live feel to it. My wife's playing flute and keys on it as well. The title One Minor refers to folklore. You can find this folklore in India. You can find it in Australia. It's quite an interesting story. It's the idea of a minor is a kind of bird. And if you see two of them, it's good luck. But if you see one of them, it's bad luck. So you get people who see one in the sky and then they're waiting about, wasting their lives, waiting for that second bird to turn up. So for me, I feel like that was so relatable because I'd spent so much time worrying about the influencer culture of, oh, I've done this thing, but I've not done that other thing yet. Like, a thing I didn't mention earlier was that a thing that I've done since we last spoke is I went on the road with my favorite guitar band of all time, Tanariwen, which ironically, a lot of my younger listeners have no idea who they are, but they're this kind of Tuareg guitar band and they mix like African folk traditions with blues music and nothing sounds like them. And I discovered them as a teenager and I'd never seen brown people play guitar in a band before at that point. And it kind of inspired me in a way that continues to the present day. And when I was on the road with one of my favorite bands, the band who are responsible for me having a line of guitars behind me, it's like, why am I not enjoying this more? I'm just worried about, oh, I have to make the show good, or I have to make sure that, you know, everything's running on time as far as the tour is going. And it's like, wow, I'm waiting for that second bird to turn up. I'm not enjoying the fact that it's like a good thing that I'm going on tour with my favorite band of all time. And this single isn't just me telling my audience to be present. It's like a journal entry to myself telling me, you know, looking in the mirror and going, hey, life's actually not too bad. Like, I think because of the old tight mismatch of the team I had before me, there was this kind of insistence that you needed to focus on things like metrics and the amount of engagement that you get. Whereas now, it's for me, it's like, I'd rather really nurture the right audience. And for me, learning that was such a big life lesson. And now that I'm more present, when I go on an Instagram live and all the comments are really positive, or people are really excited for this new single, even not even having heard it yet, it's like, wow, I have such a engaged and devoted fan base. I owe them something. I have this responsibility to them, but I can be present while I do that, you know. So one mine is like a, it's like a personal, it's the most personal song I've written in a little while. It's weird to not be putting out constantly political music. I am going to be releasing a run of singles for the next 6 weeks until the end of the year. Like every 6 weeks, there's going to be a new single out. And One Minor is the first one. There's going to be some really exciting collaborations with some singers in Norway, singer in London, someone in Canada. Like, it's fun to just be collaborating and having a bit of fun. I obviously have another very political concept album in the chamber, but I'm refining the way it sounds, and I have such a big, ambitious vision for it that I want to strike a balance where I'm enjoying the present, but in the future, I've got this project coming up that I really want to give its best shake, you know. And it's like this new single, it's a mix of like the live sounds of the shows that we've been refining over the past couple of years since Lal came out, but it's also me exploring a lot of my Tamil South Indian heritage. There's a lot of sounds in there that are very like mainstream South Indian cinema in nature. Like, I wanted to sound like you're watching like a mainstream Telugu or Tamil movie, but all the sounds are rearranged in a way that's only like the way I would do it. Like, it ends on this kind of guitar riff that's so like, that's almost stereotypically the way I play, but it's also got Murdingham samples. It's got this really like Coke studio sounding flute bits in it. Yeah, I'm excited to see what people make of it. Did you feel like it sounded a lot different to the other stuff you'd heard by me?
I think so. I think it sounded a lot more, I don't know how else to say this, but a lot more radio friendly.
Yeah, in the sense that
it was like it felt like it was following a bit more of a classic Western, that structure, both sonically and in terms of how things came about. I wouldn't say less experimental, because you still have all that experimental stuff in there and all that fusion. But at the same time, a lot of the tracks on Lal, I really didn't know where it was going to go. You know what I mean? Like, each track, it could go in a drastically different direction. But One Minor, very much, like, it has its vibe the whole way throughout the 2 minutes that it's playing.
Yeah, it's the shortest single I've ever put out. It's, like, just over 2 minutes long. I think maybe this sucks the romance and the artistry out of it to some people, but it doesn't for me personally. But I like to write a song with a function for that song in mind, because if you're trying to get a message to people, it can be something as basic as, hey, maybe don't be so homophobic or sexist, right? Or let's talk about this thing in our brown communities that we're not talking about. If you're constantly subverting expectations, on one level, that's exciting. But on the other level, you want to break it up with stuff where people know what they're going to get and they find it inviting enough to dance along to it. I was at a club night not long ago where the DJ was trying loads of stuff, but me and my mates, we'd had a bit to drink and we were a bit frustrated listening to it. We were like a cool dub beat would get going. He'd chuck some samples on and it was like, yeah, this slaps. And then it would stop after like 45 seconds. I remember being like really irritated. Like, that bit was really cool. I would have liked to vibe to that for like a few more minutes. So with that in mind, I was kind of thinking, there's a bunch of experimental tangent laden stuff that I've put out, but what would it be like if I put that creative limitation in of, no, there has to be a vibe and it's there the whole time? Like, people who've heard it, like, I was quite lucky that Vic Galloway at the BBC like debuted the song at the beginning of last week on his show. And, you know, people were quite excited that I had this kind of dancehall beat and that it was still doing its thing of going on loads of little tangents, but there was a vibe that it stuck to from the beginning into the end. And I think there's as much talent in sticking to that as there is sticking as much on as you possibly can, because there's something about getting people dancing that's going to get them to engage with the cause, if you get what I mean. Because if you think about a lot of tunes from back when that have got people to really engage with the topic, sometimes they're confrontational. How many really incredible confrontational punk tunes are there? But I think I have to really think about my audience, and like, I'm trying to hit like people in South Asian communities, specifically in the UK. They really want to dance. I don't know if they're as fussed about crossing their arms at a hardcore show and taking it in, if you know what I mean. So I think a big part of the journey from Lal coming out to One Minor coming out is me going, right, so I have developed this kind of British Asian Indian diaspora fan base, but it's like, there's certain things I grew up with that don't mean anything to them. And I have to let that go a little bit, because you can be like, hey, I grew up with all this indie rock. Like, that doesn't, it might not mean anything to them if it means a lot to me. And me understanding that is, if I'm posting stuff that they're not into, it's probably not going to reach them enough to have them engage with me more than they are. So it's not that I'm hiding parts of myself, but it's understanding what parts of yourself your audience react to, what they're interested in. Like, they're really interested in whenever I buy like a new jacket or a new hat or a new pair of sneakers. But if I go on about some boomer rock band from the 70s that I quite like, they couldn't care less. And it's just understanding that, you know, your audience are your audience and it's important to know who they are. One Mine is definitely going to lean into that. Like, I think that the younger fan base, from what they've heard of it, we played it live for the first time just there, and people really into it. I think that's the new direction as well. People just aren't expecting something that's that straightforward on first listen, but the more you delve in, the more layers they are. Yeah, it's exciting.
So just to clarify as well, you've obviously said about releasing a new single every 6 weeks going forward. Are these singles going to be sort of standalone, or are they going to be following a similar theme throughout? Like, what's the plan in terms of that?
A thing I've leaned into, and it's probably something you've noticed as well, is that due to these juggernauts like Spotify, there's definitely like a model of releasing music now where people feel a bit like gaslit into, a bit like we were talking about before we started recording, needing to post on social media all the time, needing to release music all the time. And I guess I would never judge anybody for feeling daunted by that or angry that that's the state of the industry right now. But I guess I've kind of decided my fan base are younger. They consume music in a specific way. If I'm going to connect with them or nurture that fan base more, I've kind of got to lean into what works for them, which is releasing music regularly. And for me, the next little while I ready the next album, it's not going to be thematically linked by politics the same way that the prior albums were. That doesn't mean that I'm any less political than I was. I mean, I'm doing video essays about Dalit history all this month for Dalit History Month. I'm playing Songs Against the Caste System every single gig I've ever done, so that's not going anywhere. But I'm having a bit of fun with it. I'm collaborating with some friends I've made online, like TikTok and Instagram. People who've just got in touch going, hey, I live in Norway and you live in Glasgow, but we're both Tamil, and that's exciting, right? Let's work on something and see where we can take it. So the singles, you'll know it's me playing the guitar, you'll know it's me singing here and there, but you know, there's a lot of surprises planned. I'm trying different things, and who knows how successful some of these experiments are going to be. But at the same time, I think we shouldn't be afraid to experiment ever, I don't think. Like, this isn't me saying that you're going to get a metal song next month and then an R&B song the month after. There's going to be like a through line that One Mine is setting you up for the next however many months of singles. But there's going to be a lot of like playful experimentation going on there. And some of it's going to be a lot more straightforward than people expect. Some of it might be quite different. But these singles aren't linked together the way Sacred Boar and Lal were thematically per se. But there is definitely another concept album in the chamber, but it's like the concept behind that, it's quite ambitious, it's quite broad in a way. And what I need to do between now and when I announce that album is I almost need to get my fan base really revved up and engaged with what I'm currently doing, so that when I drop the album on them, they're going to be ready to engage with the topics they're in. There's not going to be anything like wildly unpredictable there, politically speaking. I mean, I'm a leftist singer, I always will be. But you know, when you just sometimes you get old enough where you just kind of go, this isn't quite there yet, but I'm going to work on it and then one day it will be. But in the meantime, yeah, there's the narrative that you need to drop music yourself, and that can sound terrifying. I couldn't on my own completely independently drop a new song every 4 weeks. I just couldn't do it. However, maybe I'll drop a remix. Maybe I'll drop a little collab where all I'm doing is playing the guitar in the background of another friend's beat or something like that. There's a lot of that going on. And I think that me reckoning with how do British Asian or South Asian diaspora artists, or even South Asian artists, how do they communicate with each other? What's the community around their music? You can't get rid of your past, but I very much grew up with a culture of touring, like a lot of just very indie guitar-driven music tropes, whereas it's just not really how South Asian people communicate. Like, when me and my wife are very different, we're both South Asian, but my wife's background was she grew up with Kiss FM, she grew up with her cousins giving her mixtapes. And like, I speak to a lot of brown people and go, oh, how many gigs do you go to? And they're like, well, I don't really go to many gigs. Like, the idea of seeing a wee band in a in like some kind of armpit bar somewhere in the middle of town. It's just not their vibe. Or the idea of sitting through a bunch of indie bands they would never listen to just to hear me, that again isn't really what they're about. Whereas listening to remixes, listening to collaborations between artists they really like, that's more their speed. That's how they communicate. That's how they connect with the artists that they really like. Like, if you think of the artists, like, you know, I'm assuming you guys must have discussed when like a bunch of brown folk played Coachella and that was this big sea change for brown musicians as a whole. If you think about a lot of the musicians who played, you wouldn't look at any of those artists and think that's an artist who toured in smelly vans. The way they went about building a fan base was very, very different. And it took me until very recently to realize that if you want to do that, be in an indie band. But if you want to make South Asian focused music, you have to go about things in a way that's going to make sense to brown people, you know. And if they communicate and listen to music in a way where it's about getting interesting remixes done, collaborating with other brown musicians, then yeah, that's what I'm going to do. So next few weeks, going to put out another single, but I'm not going to stop talking about One Minor just because there's another song out. I think the excitement of getting to put content out all the time is I can constantly remind people how much music there is and how much music's coming out. So One Minor will be out by the time this drops. It'll be available on all platforms you listen to music on. You can follow me at my name, where I'll be going into what the song's about all over again, talking about how I put it together, all the incredible personnel involved. I've had an interesting renaissance on social media since we last spoke, because I would take to posting, like, classical music's a big part of my practice as a musician. I play a lot of Indian classical music on the guitar, and I had a viral moment a couple of weeks ago with one of those videos. And ever since then, people kind of expect incessant guitar content from me. And I mean, I play the guitar a lot. You can see them all in the background. But I want to strike a balance between, yep, I play the guitar a lot, it pays my bills, but I do other things too. And I think that it's exciting to see that I'm at the forefront of exploring what else my audience like for me and where that goes. So really appreciate being asked on the show and, you know, having a catch up as well, because you guys probably speak to so many musicians and the idea of being allowed to return is a big deal, because sometimes you feel like it's one and done, like there's like a revolving door of people and you're like, yep, here's your 5 minutes on our platform. Because I'll be honest, when you consider that a lot of that north of the Midlands, there's not a lot of opportunity for South Asian musicians or artists to talk about themselves or what they're doing. So the idea of a northern hub for that is incredible. Like, respect to you guys for doing what you're doing.
Nah, thank you. I mean, obviously, it's not like we're having you on every single month to be like, okay, this month I did this, this month I did that. But having a whole year and a bit, like, I mean, it's evident from the past half an hour that we've been speaking that you've been up to loads, and it's been great to talk about that. Just as a closing thing as well, it's my understanding that you got some quite exciting stuff coming up in the summer, so I don't know if you want to chat about that briefly.
Yeah for sure. I realized that I mentioned it to you because we're friends and I wanted to tell you, but there I need to be a bit cloaked about it, but I will announce it soon. There's going to be a South Asian festival in the summer. It's a really exciting one by the amazing people who've put on other big South Asian festivals. I've practically given the game away by saying that, but there's going to be like a northern version of an iconic South Asian festival in the UK happening in the summer. It will be happening in Manchester in July, and I have been asked to perform at it. And, you know, as you can tell from my accent, I'm not local to Manchester or the surrounding area, but I'm from the north of the UK, and while Manchester might be south for me, there's a northern identity regardless of what colour or race you are, and to be accepted as part of that is this massive deal. And I think that being invited to play in Manchester again, especially on such a big stage, is incredibly exciting. And without naming names, I think I'm getting really close to the line I can cross. I'm getting as close as I'm falling into it, but it'll be on the 20th of July. So if you've seen me in Manchester before, or maybe you were at Manchester Jazz Festival and I played last year and you enjoyed what you heard, I'll be doing a full band show on July the 20th in Manchester at a festival that will be announced. It is a big deal. I can tell you that much. But it's like, I will have released a good few singles by then. I'll be playing the best of what was on Lal alongside those new singles. It's really exciting that people are inviting me back. I keep thinking that the next big gig is going to be the last big gig that I get, like Roundhouse, Dialed In or whatever. But being asked to play this festival is such a big deal, because for me, it's this like intersection of the fact that I love being British Asian as an artist, but I'm from the north of the UK and it's a very specific identity. In our first conversation, me and you talked about how it's quite, not segregated, a dodgy word, but it feels different. Like when I'm in Newcastle, when I'm in Manchester, the vibe's a bit different to when I'm out in London or when I'm out in Brighton or where I'm out in Birmingham. Do you know what I mean? And it's not necessarily a bad thing, but there's a kinship, I think, that Scottish people feel with Newcastle, with Manchester. There's something about it when you're there that if it weren't for the accent, you'd forget you were in a different country, technically speaking. Like, you feel at home.
Definitely looking forward to that. Well, thank you so much for taking time to speak to us today. It's been a pleasure.